This is the Limbit Opic Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Limbit Opic Show for the fourth hour on what is still a Saturday here in the United Kingdom. We've covered quite extensively the two developing stories. Thanks to Basil and Pelle for being with me for a couple of hours. One of those stories is the murder of, it seems like, six people in a shopping mall in Sydney by a man who did not seem to have a terrorist intent. He was simply a common criminal. We don't know his motivations, but we know he's dead. That story will no doubt develop over time. The danger has passed, but the grieving begins, and we remember the victims rather than the assailant. I always feel that would be the appropriate thing to do in this sort of situation. We also talked about the escalating tensions between Israel and Iran. And it seems that Iran has seized a ship, or there's Iranian involvement in the seizing of a ship. And the question we've been asking, myself, Pelle, and Basil, is, does this constitute the retaliation, or is there more to come? Fair play to Pelle and Basil. They predicted at the beginning of the conversation I had with them that something like this would occur, and it seems to have occurred. Is Iran playing a long game? Where does this end up? And what will Netanyahu, the premier of Israel, do next? That's a developing story. If something happens there, then we'll let you know. But I wanted to move on to a different subject now as well, something which we often return to in today's News Talk, TNT, the question of the COVID inquiry. And what's not in it, as well as what's in it. And regular viewers know that I bitterly regret having one of the injections because I believe it did more harm than good to me personally, and there are others in a similar situation. Well, there are other aspects of the COVID inquiry which may be found wanting. There are some who believe that the problem isn't so much what COVID did to us, but what COVID policy did to us. And in a moment, we're going to be speaking to one such person, Hugh McCarthy, who is an educationalist and has highlighted some glaring omissions in how the COVID inquiry is being carried out. He's going to be with me in a minute on the Limbit Opic Show right here on TNT.
It's the stuff.
It's that division
people are talking about.
And that cluelessness that they want to push.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hugh McCarthy, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on to discuss about COVID. Before we go further, we've got something in common. I actually grew up in Northern Ireland, and I considered going to what was then called the New University of Ulster, and I believe you live right next to it, if that's true.
I do, yes. And I went there, actually. One of my degrees is from the University of Ulster, and I've lectured there as well. So, yeah, we have a good common bond there, Limbit.
Absolutely. And it was a beautiful location, very rural. And I suppose there was an incentive to study because there wasn't anything else to do in the neighborhood. And I'm not sure if that remains the case, but it was a true success story. I remember I was at school. I went to, for those who know about Northern Ireland, the Royal Belfast Academical Institution, INST for short. And we went on a visit there as we were looking at our university options. And it had just been opened, I think. It was in 1982, 83. And it seems to have gone from strength to strength. And you did, what, 23 years as an educationalist, as a head teacher?
Well, a couple of things. What you're saying there, first of all, as you know, the University of Ulster is a lovely location, sited on the shores of Belfast Lough. But it's actually moving its main campus to the centre of Belfast. Actually, it's part of redevelopment in an area that... I'll just say it needs redevelopment. I think that's what I would say, Limbit. And of course, our alma maters are the same. I too went to the Royal Belfast Academical Institution, and I'd forgotten that when we opened our conversation, as did dabble in the history, Perry. I was in Perry House. I don't know if you're from East Belfast, chairman of Harland Wolff and workman from the yard on the other side. But anyway... 23 years, no, I think I could claim 52 years, actually, 45 years in schools, 23 as a head teacher, 4 as a lecturer, in the University of Ulster, and I sit currently, I've been a member of two of Northern Ireland's leading education councils. I'm currently a ministerial appointee on one of them. So even though I'm getting on a bit, I'm still involved in education. So I can claim 52 years and add it to when I come out of university, you can judge my age.
That's quite a pedigree that you have there. I can claim 41 years since my first broadcast interview, but you still beat me even there. I did start early. It was a program called Coming of Age in Britain, actually, for a Northern Ireland station. What, before we go into talking about COVID, that's a very long time in a very high-pressure environment. Knowing teachers as I do, I know many of them end up feeling physically and psychologically exhausted by the work they do. How did you stick it for half a century?
Well, it's an interesting phraseology, stick it. I got a lot of satisfaction out of it. If a job's worth doing, it is bound to bring its stressors and challenges. And of course it did. I was fortunate. I was broadly in a supportive teaching force. The chairman of my governors in essential relationship were all very supportive. And I retired when it was my turn to retire, and I overlapped with the lectureship and the membership boards to wind down. I have a very, very satisfying role to play, I think.
I considered becoming a teacher myself when I was 18. I did actually start teaching qualification in 2011, I think it was. But then life took me in a different direction. I was actually the Global Human Resources Training and Development Manager for a large multinational company. So I did end up in a kind of training role. But I don't imagine it was anything like as difficult as what you've done. In your 50 years, before we go into talking about COVID, in your 50 years, what did you learn about the human ability to learn? What are the secrets of success in mining the gold in people's heads?
I think the longer I worked, I think self-esteem played a huge role in a child's willingness and capacity to learn. And self-esteem is linked to respect. And if a child is respected and cared for, they feel a self-worth. So if the institution values them, then it radiates from parts of the institution. The teachers care, the management cares, the office staff care, the dining staff care. And this comes across in general, in a general way they are addressed, mm-hmm. and the way they are treated if something goes wrong. And is there someone there to help them? And are you providing something which meets their needs? And if they think you are, if they know you are trying to meet their needs and to help them, by and large, that is a recipe for success. It's not easy. I came from a position that there are no bad children. There are children whose life experiences have led them to various challenges and a view of society and authority which isn't helpful. So my recipe for success is to try to build self-esteem and to build ways of doing that into the school day-to-day activities.
I really relate to that. I've been writing a book for 15 years now about training and the five main rules of training. And I think I align with you when I think about the best teachers who seem selflessly committed to the learning of the group and the individual. And, you know, I been quite successful in different walks of life, but I always feel quite humble when I meet teachers who don't get paid all that much, but send people out into the world equipped with the ability to make the most of themselves. And I sometimes regret the fact that I didn't take a rather more quiet line and just become a teacher myself. But it must take a particular temperament for you to have done this for over half a century.
The answer to that is it must have done. we only have, this is me and you. I don't have a plan B for me. I am what I am, and with all of that entails. And you do have to have an affinity for children. You have to kind of sort of basically like them to work in an environment. Sorry, the children all day. It's part of what should be part of our education system, is skills and aptitude analysis. If you're the sort of person that doesn't want to be surrounded by young people, then don't take a job in teaching. That's so obvious. I think that part of the skill of running a school is that you appoint teachers with a caring vision and a similar vision to your own, and that's down to the interview process, that you can seek to draw out that actually this person cares about A, their job, and B, the importance of their job.
You and I went to the same school, and it was quite a strict school in its own way, but it worked for me. It was a grammar school, for those who know what the grammar schools are, and it was in the state system. But I saw others who didn't do so well in that teaching environment. To what extent is there a lottery, so that I appreciated the discipline and I liked the way that I was taught, but my brother did not, and he didn't do so well in that same school? So to what extent is it a lottery whether you happen to get a good education or a bad one?
Schools are more accountable than they were in our day. My parents were never set foot in the school. So I think that accountability has helped. Parents are certainly more willing to let you know if you're not doing the right thing. And I suppose one of my greatest challenges were the parents, not the children. A lottery, in Northern Ireland, we still have selection at 10, with which I have to say I don't agree. The school that I worked in was all ability. Latterly, the 23 years were an all ability school in Portadown, which, as you know, Portadown, you would know it brought its own challenges. But it was an all ability school, not mixed ability classes. But all ability, so all of the children learned together, and it meant that they saw each other's strengths and weaknesses on sports pitches, in choirs, drama productions. So a child just wasn't what position they were in mass. There was more to them. As you know, those socialization qualities are important when you go out into the big life. It has been a discussion for Northern Ireland about selection from whenever the system was established, Lembit. Where you go from where we are, how we got to where we are, is a matter for our history. And we'd take a couple of hours and probably bore your audience.
The selection process did work for me. But not so much for my brother, as I say. It somehow just didn't work out for him. That's fascinating, and I could go into more detail about education policy. I was actually one of the people who defended the selection process and the grammar system when I was Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, because there was a threat to remove it. And I suppose because it worked for me, I didn't really want to see that going, but that's for another time. After the break, though, I'd like to speak with you, Hugh, about COVID and COVID policy and the damage that may have done to young people. You're listening to Lembotopic here on today's News Talk. I'm with Hugh McCarthy, and we're going to talk about the impact of the COVID policies on mental health, something which seems to be missing in the COVID inquiry. Don't go away. I'll see you in a minute.
TNT's Dirk Pohlman.
There was a plan on the British side to immediately after the victory over Germany to continue the war, to push the weakened Soviet Union back over over backwards. Yeah, so that is something that is not well known. That plan has been, you could find it on the internet, and then it's off and on sometimes again. It's very difficult. It's not long. It's something like, if I recall correctly, something of 30 pages, I would say. I read it.
The Soviets had this coup in Czechoslovakia in 1948. And that appeared as the Soviets really was pushing forward, and they would, they thought that this means that we have to start an alliance against the Soviets. And that was NATO became.
The Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
It sounds pretty good.
It sounds real, dude.
Not bad, huh?
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Lembotopic Show. I'm with Hugh McCarthy. Seb says, Lembit, if you're writing a book on training disciplines, isn't chapter one estimate how long a given task will take to complete like writing a book? I have had books published, Seb. I know what I'm doing, but 15 years is a long time. I agree. I think it's because I've bigged it up in my mind too much. The other books I've written in between got banged out quite quickly, but you make a fair point, Seb. You do make a fair point. I'll probably still be talking about writing the book in 15 years. Hugh, you're a man of action. You wouldn't be waiting 15 years to write a book, I'm sure. But you have written some authoritative material about the COVID policies. Now, my understanding is that it's not COVID that bothers you. It's actually the policies of COVID that bother you. Tell us about that.
Well, you're right. Right from the start, right from the start, I felt it was wrong. Totally disproportionate. It was obvious that closing people's places of work, closing schools, closing churches, denying people the right to travel, it was obvious the damage that would cause. So it was morally wrong. It was, fortunately for me, very soon the science lined up with it. So I started doing my own research. The Diamond Princess should have started and finished this. As you know, the cruise liner where almost nobody died despite the age of the fixed air system. And the same is true of the experience in Italy. So I very quickly began to read the work of Professor Levitt, Lee, Bhakti, Gupta. I heard Nick Hudson, Professor Hennigan, Enos later, Joel Smalley, David Bell, Fenton, Hinton. And these were people, if I want my car fixed, I don't go to the guy next door. I go to people that have worked in risk and epidemiology all their lives. And I went to these people to see what they were saying. And very soon, the Great Barrington Declaration gave substance to that, and Collateral Global and Vendetta, of which I'm a member, I liked their visions. They were people-focused. They seemed to care about people. They spoke about the effects of people. So I began this after the newsletter question, why schools were closed? Why was nobody talking about getting children back to school? And I'm talking here about April, May 2020. So that so I was asked to research it, and I did. Indeed, I could come up with no answer. And that began the first of 11 articles in the Belfast newsletter and 11 presentations to my first board, evidence-based, asking the very question. Why indeed were schools closed? What was the evidence? And what was the need? And of course, there was no need. It was known then that children were not affected. In those days, Professor Ioannidis, the leading epidemiologist, or at least the most cited one, children then, according to him, 99.97 survival chance, even if they got COVID. He's upgraded to 99.9997% survival chance. I have more chance of dying if I get into the car. And secondly, but that was known at the time. What was also known at the time was that children don't transmit. And Public Health England produced a report that said they don't transmit. And Professor Woolhouse from Sage said the same thing, 2020. So they knew they weren't at risk. They knew they didn't transmit. So what happened to the European Convention on the Rights of the Child, Article 3, that all decisions made by public bodies should put children first? What did we do? We closed schools. So what was that likely to do to children? And what it did, and I'll summarise it here. You close schools and you put masks on them and you fill them with fear. Mm-hmm. You don't need to be a scientist to know the damage that that's going to cause to children. 80% of a child's brain is growth is in the first 3 years. But that's exactly the time when children learn to socialize from them and their mother. That's when they learn. If you cover a mother's face with a mask, how are they going to learn about reactions and alarm? And Ofsted reported that we had Ofsted now, that's, as you know, the body that inspects and reports on school. We have a generation of children who, babies that can't talk properly, learning delays, delays in independence and toilet training, speech delays. And the speech therapist said we have a generation suffering, as I said, lack of communication, which affects children. And then you have Dr. Golden and Professor Hill of the hospital, the leading children's hospital, saying they're 2 years behind in their development by the time they go to primary school. One in four children not toilet trained. And what do you think isolating children is going to do to their mental health? Mm-hmm. We denied them all of the things that nourish their mental health, we being society. We banned them from school. We stopped them playing sport. No evidence of transmission out of doors. We banned them from playing sport. We locked them up. We put masks on them. They weren't allowed to go to church, go to parties, socialize, go to a bar. What on earth did we expect to happen? The shock would be if we weren't experienced 1.4 million children, according to the NHS, in need of mental health treatment. 1.4 million children. That's appalling. And development and education falls all the way up the age range. The NEEPS, that's the American system for, same as our statutory assessment, the worst results in their history. The English results, the worst since in English and maths, reading and numeracy, the worst since 2006. 1.6 billion children across the world out of school. What are you expecting to happen to education? These are frightening numbers.
So 1.6 billion children, that could leave, if you're correct, that could leave a permanent scar on the legacy, educational and social development legacy we leave for an entire generation.
Well, actually, the world, the numbers that I'm quoting, by the way, come from UNESCO. Mm-hmm. So the 1.6 billion is from them due to school closures across the world. The World Bank actually used that phrase, a permanent scar on a generation of children, because people talk about catch-up, but without really explaining how that's done. For example, reading, functional literacy, which determines our life, is around about 90 points. If you're 86, well, you can go up or down. But you get from 86 up to functional reading between the ages of 9 and 13. After the age of 13, something happens to the synapses. And teaching 13-year-old plus to read is a law of diminishing returns. So for those children who were out of school for 2 years during that vital time, they aren't going to be able to catch up unless there's an extreme amount of attention given to literacy, if they can catch up at all.
In a sense, I recognized I was lucky because one of my children was just before school age, and the other one was born during the lockdown. So they weren't affected in the sense that she wasn't going to school anyway. Having said that, my belief is, exactly as you say, if you take a child out of school for 1 or 2 years, it's just years that you'll never get back. And I wonder then, with your interpretation of the situation, why is none of this being considered in the COVID inquiry?
Beggar's belief. Because actually, is somebody afraid? You see, I lived in a world, or at least I thought I did, but I don't, of accountable democracy, where you could ask a question of a civil servant or a politician and reasonably expect an answer. So what you said, there have been 50 articles in now, published articles, 15 presentations, but innumerable, I think 115 emails to our Department of Health, our Chief Medical Officer, the Department of Education. I'm not terribly popular, I should imagine. Asking these very questions. And I'll give you an example of my fear for democracy and civil rights. At the beginning of all this, I became rather friendly with Professor Gupta and Bhattacharya and Kula, the Great Barrington Three, actually. And indeed, my first article, which was about getting children back to school, children are better off at school, and that's where they should be, was actually in the inaugural edition of Platter Global's newsletter. And Professor Bhattacharya edited it. But I could no longer contact them when I was banned from LinkedIn from asking our Chief Medical Officer a perfectly reasonable question: why are we vaccinating babies and children against an illness that they're not affected by? Now, I thought, in my naivety, if you're intending to inject my child or my grandchild or me with something, I have a reasonable entitlement to know why you're doing it. But no, it got me banned, and I'm still banned, incidentally.
So let me just check. Just before you go on, because I want to really be clear about this. You were banned because you dared to question COVID vaccination policy. That's what you're saying?
Yeah, from LinkedIn, yes. And the BBC didn't like me saying that masks harm children, so I was cut off there. And in Scotland, where Professor Enos invited me to talk under the title of "What Are We Doing to Our Children?" You wouldn't have thought that was the that was a title of which rebellions are made.
Yeah.
But no, we were banned. We were banned from four venues, and I eventually conducted that in a park, a freezing cold night. So I thought I had a right to express an opinion. I thought I had a right to get an answer. I thought and asked for a risk-benefit analysis, justifying masks. I mean, I couldn't take a child across the road or give them an aspirin without a risk-benefit analysis. But all of a sudden, the government can put a mask on the child's face for 8 to 9 hours a day without carrying out a risk analysis. I thought that was obscene. Now, one of the reasons that you keep doing this, or I keep doing it, if we don't highlight this, all the pain will be in vain. And they might do it again. I didn't deliberately set out to be a poet there. But if we don't highlight this, they may well do it again. I would like, just before I come back, to these are government pronouncements. Because I'm of the very strong view that you knew it from the start, that it wasn't deadly. So, and you knew your policies, all 8 or 9 of them, didn't work, weren't necessary. Listen to this now, if I may. If you keep children out of school, every single one of the children you keep out of school is disadvantaged. Professor Chris Whitty, 2021. Next one. It has nothing to do with the children. It was to keep the parents at home. The Northern Ireland Chief Medical Officer. What is frightening is that there was little consideration given to the disadvantage that pupils would face from school closures. Robert Halfland, Chairman of the House of Commons Select Committee. Now, I don't think any comment needs to be made over those statements. And the last one from Ioannidis, I realise he's not going. Modellers were astronomically wrong in their predictions, and the world is paying the price. We are.
My daughter was 3 or 4, and she got COVID. We tested it. No symptoms at all. No diminution in her energy levels or anything. I got COVID, which I would describe as bad flu. It wasn't pleasant. Got over it. My second child was born during COVID pandemic, and the mother had COVID. And as far as we can tell, she's fine. I wonder, therefore, why is it that we demonize this disease above all others when flu can kill the vulnerable anyway, ordinary flu?
The question why were all the goalposts changed? You mentioned you tested positive for COVID. You tested positive for something using a PCR test that even the inventor, Gary Mullis, Nobel Prize winner, said wasn't fit for the purpose for which it was being used. It was being used at far too high a cycle rate. It would have picked up last year's COVID, let alone this year's. It was the same as using a breathalyzer, far too sensitive. We were using it at 45, a frequency of 45, when 25 might have detected something, but it wouldn't have detected if you were infectious. It would have detected if you had a virus. Wouldn't have detected if I was going to give it to somebody else. And the question must be raised. The definition of cases moved from a hospitalization to testing positive using a flawed test. So that gives you your first step. So then you have to get a lot of cases, use a hugely sensitive test to get them. That's a PCR test. And then instruct the doctors to classify any death with COVID as of COVID. And there you've got your pandemic and your fear. A number from Northern Ireland, Lembit. in 42 months of a deadly epidemic, pandemic, 275 people died of COVID at a rate of 6 or 7 per month, the same rate as flu, except that nobody died of flu. The youngest was 38. Who gave me that information? The Department of Health, Northern Ireland. So the government had all the statistics. Lockdowns were not part of anybody's pandemic plans before 2019. Why was that? I've got endless professors saying that now.
Hold that thought. I need to go to a break, but I want to ask you what questions should be asked in the COVID inquiry. And then I'm going to see if we can answer them too. We're speaking with Hugh McCarthy here, who very critical, not of COVID, but of COVID policy, and says the real damage was done by the policy itself. Don't go anywhere. We'll have a little bit more time with Hugh. And if there is an update on the Iran-Israel thing, we'll let you know about that as well. This is all on the Lembotopic Show on today's News Talk. See you in a moment.
Military families often sacrifice precious time away from loved ones while serving our country. And for those with children, the separation can be especially difficult.
We were worried that with him leaving, that she would lose those connections with her dad.
Some of life's best moments happen between parents, children, and the pages of a good book. United Through Reading provides that connection.
You can watch your mom or dad read a book to you, and it almost feels like they're really there.
We ensure they remain a consistent, meaningful part of their children's lives, no matter the distance.
Just seeing Jacob recognize Daddy again after a long time just melted my heart.
And now, as we're facing greater isolation from our loved ones, United Through Reading is also available to veterans. Learn more about United Through Reading and download our free secure app at unitedthroughreading.org.
She used to dance and dream of a better life, a brighter future. Today, thanks to Children International and friends like you, she dances for the world. Together, we give children in poverty a chance to set their sights high and achieve their dreams. Learn more about Children International and join us in our life-changing work at children.org today.
Lembit Opic on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the final part of my show today. I'm with Hugh McCarthy, who is questioning why the welfare of our children wasn't taken into account in a more sensible and data-based way during the COVID lockdowns. He points out that the overwhelming majority, if not all children, were pretty close to immune to any significant negative effects of the disease. And yet we shut down their education for a couple of years. Hugh, looking at the COVID inquiry, there seems to be a marked absence of the very kind of discussions that you're talking about. Why do you think they're avoiding it? Now, I asked you that vaguely before, but do you feel that people are concerned that they might have to pay compensation, or do you think that politicians are worried that they'll be exposed as making the wrong decision or something?
I think democratic accountability is part of the reason. Nobody wants to admit now that the reason they did it and that they were wrong from the start. But I suspect that plays a big hold, because actually, when you come down to straightforward questions, and just to go back, Lembit, no healthy child has died of COVID anywhere in the world, according to the FDA, for example. Professor Ioannidis, Scott Atlas. So in that context, I would be asking questions, which is where you left me up. If there was no evidence of risk to children, and you knew it, and no evidence of risk from children, and no evidence of transmission out of doors, and no evidence of asymptomatic transmission. And you did not conduct a risk-benefit analysis on the harms to children. And we listed them briefly: developmental, education, psychological, socialization, mental health. Huge list of them. My questions would be, could you please tell me why you closed schools? Simple. What was your evidence base? Why did you use masks? You knew they didn't work. There's a huge volume of peer-reviewed research showing that masks don't work for viruses. Now, Professor Heineken told the Northern Ireland executive in August 2020, tell people to wear masks, but don't say they work because there's no evidence. Now, normally speaking, Len, but if you know a professor from Oxford comes over to Northern Ireland and tells us something, we're falling over ourselves.
Yeah.
And Professor Heineken told the Northern Ireland executive and has continued to tell us. And on that, nowhere in the world showed a decline in cases when masks were mandated. So why did you mandate them? Why did you, question three, why did you use a PCR cycle rate well in excess of what was recommended? In fact, why did you use PCR tests at all? Number four, why did you implement vaccine passports, cost the Northern Ireland budget £20 million and rising, by the way, for 5 weeks when you knew they didn't work? Why did you introduce them? Next one. Why did you isolate children when you knew it was going to do huge damage? Next one. Why did you promote the vaccination of children when you knew they weren't at risk? And you knew because Pfizer told you that they hadn't tested it for transmission. So there are six questions. But you see, the answer to this question, the other question you started with, can't answer them. You can't answer them, actually, when you think about it. And maybe that's why they are not paying attention to children. A terrible indictment, actually, of our system. We allegedly sent all the children home to protect whom?
Just a couple of quotes and questions here. Jane Black asks, hi, Lambert, where can we get in touch with Hugh? Has he got an X or Twitter account? Is there a way that people get in touch with you?
Well, I have a small Twitter account, but I have a Substack called Hugh's Newsletter, which does rather well. And all these articles and all the material I'm quoting from the various authoritative sources. And by the way, I tried to write through the eyes of a teacher, but using the expertise of those who've spent a lifetime in these matters. By the way, and could I just say, one of the key differences was that the people that I was relating to answered my questions. Government officials told me they never answered any questions such as these.
So what you're painting here is a rather dark scenario, because what it's telling me is, number one, as I've seen with my own children, they weren't in any way badly affected by COVID. Number two, the education system was shut down pointlessly. Number three, they seem to want to avoid this responsibility because they're not asking the questions in the inquiry. And number four, the whole thing was pretty futile anyway, because COVID didn't lead to some significantly worse deaths than what we normally call flu. But yet we shut down a large proportion of the global economy in the name of pandemic. I wonder if the conspiracy theories might be right.
Well, actually, I reject the word conspiracy. Theories, perhaps, but not conspiracy. I thought in a scientific community and indeed a democracy, you were allowed to debate. And the whole purpose is to bring alternative ideas and thoughts to the table. But actually, they didn't have to look very far to find alternative top-line people. Levitt, Nobel laureate, Stanford University. I think lockdown saved no lives. It will have saved a few road accidents, but the social damage, domestic abuse, divorces, alcoholism has been extreme. Lockdown was a huge mistake. Bright Hope, in his opening statement to the COVID professor, Royal Commission, the lockdowns, masking, social distancing, hygiene, testing, tracking and tracing were introduced based on flawed science. My goodness. Wheelhouse, on Sage Professor, lockdowns, an idea concocted by China and who made a bad situation worse. A global public health failure on a massive scale. It was untried and not thought through. Harmful restrictions were imposed without evidence that such measures work. Even when they became clear they weren't working, UK continued to impose them. The most recent research, recent research from our own University of Ulster, from Professor Fenton and Dr. Jerry Quinn, mirroring the Swiss policy review, that said almost every single government intervention, in particular lockdowns, school closures, mass mandates, mass testing, contact tracing, as well as vaccine passports, have been entirely ineffective and unjustified, while causing almost unprecedented social and economic harm. And they put it down to seasonality. What caused it? Seasonality above all. They didn't have to look too far, but they didn't look at all for alternative voices. And that's my, that's been my cry, plea from the start, Linda. These authoritative voices were there and they didn't ask them, didn't look.
Let me read you a message from Hermetica. It's quite long, very relevant though. Excellent guest. That's you. And the authorities are still at it. My neighbor visited a friend recently in hospital. He said she got COVID there. I asked, how did they know? And did she have any symptoms? He said she was tested. And no, she didn't have any symptoms. He went on to say the whole hospital was full of COVID. How did he know? Because he said they test them all when they go in. I asked him, did anyone in there show any symptoms? And he shook his head. No, all asymptomatic. This is how you create a fake pandemic. That's an interesting point. I had something and it wasn't very good, but I recovered before the pandemic's vaccine thing began. And as I say, I bitterly regret having three. And yes, I did have three of them. And the third one messed me up and I still have problems with that.
The question that they refused to answer is, why did you need a vaccine in the first place?
Yeah.
But you see, that's where I'm at. Why was it needed? Why weren't traditional medical practice used? I mean, I had pneumonia, for example, a long time ago now. I don't want it again, Lambert.
Yeah.
I don't want it again. However, I wasn't vaccinated against it. Let me remind you what they did. At the time of a so-called medical emergency, doctor's surgeries were closed. Mm-hmm. It's like closing fire stations when there's a fire. At the very time they were frightening the lives out of everybody, churches were closed. Now, where would old people, elderly people, go to get pastors and spirituals? We are told, fear not, fear ye not. And then they allowed elderly people to die alone, to be sick alone, to be buried alone. What sort of people were they that did this? These are the sort of questions. Why did you do that? It was simply appalling. And worse, as you well know, Lambert, all our institutions bought into it. Where was Save the Children? Yeah. Where was looking after the homeless? Where were mental health institutions? All those things suddenly disappeared in a pandemic, which actually, if you ask the local churchmen and the local undertaker, we weren't seeing hearses in the streets. It was obvious straight away. Obvious. It may have been called COVID. It got a name. It got a name. And then the media kicked in, scared the life out of everybody. But why did people not do their own research? You research a holiday, a car, a house. Mm-hmm. Here's a deadly thing affecting the lives of you and your children, and we believe the government? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. A well-known bastion of truth, sadly. So all the pillars of our society that we relied on, I know we're running out of time. Dear, oh, dear.
I would say to you that I would have taken it much more seriously looking back if the progenitors of the policies weren't ignoring them themselves. Matt Hancock called out breaking the rules. Senior government advisor called out breaking the rules. The prime minister called out breaking the rules. It seems to me, if you take a step back from it, the inference was that the great proletariat needed to obey the rules because it was dangerous. But if you were rich and powerful, then COVID didn't really apply to you, did it? If you were to give one piece of advice to the government or to the public, what would it be when it comes to COVID?
Well, when it comes to COVID policy, I think do your own research. Think for yourselves. Hold the politicians duly accountable and don't give up. I think that's where I'm at.
Do you think they would be able to impose another lockdown again?
That's a very interesting question. Do I think they'd be able to impose another mask mandate?
Mask mandate and lockdown.
Yes. Well, that's why we, you, me, and others continue to speak out, because the more people are informed, the more actually the stuff is transparent, then the less likelihood that they'll be able to scare people into doing, of course, they're probably trying about climate and other aspects. But the media had a major role to play here. And sadly, I'm into conjecture, but if you look at the major financiers of the World Health Organization, Imperial College, the BBC, much of the media, if you follow the money and then look at who's made the money, I think you could end up with the answers to the questions. I mean, what does the pharmaceutical industry need? What does an armaments company need? What does a computer making company need? I think you have your answer there.
It's fascinating to speak with you, Hugh, and I hope that viewers of the show will feel that there are some very sound voices calling these people to account. We're out of time, Hugh, but please do come back, because I feel that there's a lot of mileage to be had in the campaign that you're running. So if you are willing to come back again, I'd love to have you back, not least because sure. You went to the same school as me, which is a good thing. Thank you so much. That's Hugh McCarthy, bringing me to the end of my time with you today. Thank you also to Basil and Pelle, who were really fantastic with the rolling news. I don't know that anything else has happened in terms of the Iran-Israel situation, but let's hope it's not too much. I'll be back again tomorrow with more news and comments, so do please join me for those 4 hours. Big thank you to the team. They've been absolutely brilliant today with some technical challenges. Big thank you to Charlotte as well, and to Mike and Jenny. So I will be back tomorrow. Make sure you're here for another 4 hours of the Len Vitovic Show on today's News Talk TNT. And stay with TNT. We've got the facts. As long as you've got the opinions, we're going to get on brilliantly. See you tomorrow.